with the December 11th extended edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. In the studio with me is Ed Fry, attorney at law and Free Radio Santa Cruz supporter, as well as Art Danner Nemesis. Plus, we have a roaming guest who has apparently returned from a lockup, God knows where. Your full name, sir, is?
Dave Hardy.
This is the Merry Prankster, Dave, back again in Free Radio Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz Land after being locked up for weeks and weeks in some ridiculous drug prohibition shit. Is that the story?
Yeah.
Welcome back, Dave.
Well, it's good to be back. Good to be alive.
I'm glad to have you back, and be sure you get closer to the mic the next time you talk, otherwise we won't know you're alive. Anything new in the last week, Ed? You mentioned the methyl bromide scandal. You mentioned Sam kicking people out of Fort Ord, let's say, not fulfilling his promise to keep them in Fort Ord housing. You've mentioned, I guess, a couple of other aspects of what you consider as far as a stand on NAFTA and GATT, or let's just say one promise one way, then a vote the other way. Anything new that you wish to bring up that you consider to be of concern in terms of what Farr has done? Or let's put it this way, issues you feel Farr has not raised that you think are important to raise.
Well, let me go back and talk about his trilogy of insults to the voters on the prison issues. First of all, in 1992, he took $25,000 from the Prison Guards Union and then voted for three new prisons at the cost of $1 billion to the taxpayers, even though we had already built 18 new prisons in the prior 12 years. Here's this great champion of education. Instead of spending the money on the schools and helping increase the teacher salaries, which were at that time and still are pretty damn low, you know, he votes for three new prisons so that we can put more of our horrible young people back in where they belong, of course, you know, behind bars.
Right.
Which is real productive of God knows what. But then, that was his first insult. The second insult was when I raised the issue with him in 1993 publicly at a public forum when he was running for Congress, and I was running for Congress back then too. I raised the issue and I asked him to explain his vote. He refused to explain his vote. He refused to discuss it. Mm-hmm. That was insult number two to the voters. The third insult was happened a week ago Monday when I raised the incident with him in front of the Seaside City Council, and I asked him, Sam, why did you vote for three new prisons? You know, at the cost of $1 billion. And he said, oh, Ed, you got your facts wrong. That was just a vote to put it on the ballot so that the voters could approve it or not, which is a total lie. I went and checked the next day. Absolute lie. He was so, when you corner him and there's no way out and he's got to discuss it, his choice is to lie. So three insults to the voters on that issue alone.
Now, what about issues that haven't been raised before that you've been thinking about addressing that perhaps have not been addressed that should be addressed? What are anything in that line?
Well, I got him at that same meeting in Seaside. I got him to agree publicly that he would debate me as part of the campaign on the drug war. So that's something we can all look forward to after the March primary. I'm going to set a date with him as to when we can debate the drug war, which I feel is the most counterproductive policy since slavery in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what he thinks.
Well, what do you say to those who feel that young people's use of marijuana and other dangerous drugs, or drugs if improperly used, would be dangerous, whether they be psychedelics, cocaine, heroin, PCP, that kind of use will necessarily increase, as for instance alcohol use increased after alcohol prohibition was thrown out? And indeed, alcohol use among young people is a major disaster, a major danger, and next to nicotine, alcohol is the most dangerous drug, and some regard it as more dangerous because the nicotine is more fatal over the long run. Alcohol disrupts families, destroys people in accidents, a huge social cost. What's to be done about if we decriminalize all these drugs? Even, you know, we can say, oh, they're still criminal for people under 18, but won't they in fact be much more accessible? I mean, if they're liquor stores, if they're drug stores on every corner, what's your answer to critics who suggest this problem?
Well, first of all, people say, gee, that would send the wrong message to kids. And my thesis is that we're sending the wrong message to kids right now. I mean, we put badges and guns on cops and send them into classrooms to teach pharmacology, and the kids, it's like waving a red flag in front of these kids. They don't believe what they hear, and what's more, since it's coming from a cop, the first thing they want to do is rush out and do what the cops tell them not to do. And they also know that the cops are lying to them when they say that marijuana is just as dangerous as cocaine and so on and so on. Because they know it's not true. They know their parents use it. They know their friends' parents use it. And they function just fine. Just like our Peter Katzelberger here, the planning director for 19 years, who was just busted with his wife for growing 22 plants, 21 of which were female. So they know that
what's
people...
What's the significance of those 21 being female?
The significance of the 21 out of 22 being female is that it looks like they knew what they were doing.
I see. So they were growing plants that were, in fact, usable and saleable if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the judge did everything he could to fall over out of his chair almost to try to lighten the problem for the Katzelbergers, and he finally gave them diversion, which means they don't have any penalty at all, they don't have any charge at all, they don't have to do anything except go to a couple of drug classes and pay $100 fee for those drug classes, and then their case will be dismissed in 6 months.
Unlike, let's say, your client that you're defending on two felony counts of cultivation with intent to sell?
Yeah. He's got his hair is too long, and his lifestyle is not acceptable, and therefore he's going to be subject to prosecution. He had a few more plants than the Katzelbergers besides, but, you know, it's the hypocrisy is just kind of drips off these people.
I agree with you, of course.
All pores.
But let me get back to the point. You have not answered the question, will not decriminalizing drugs and selling them in corner stores like liquor result in more accessibility to young people and probably a rise in abuse?
Well, no. Here's what I see will happen. The use of firearms is going to go way down. Among children. The violence among children is going to go way down if drugs are decriminalized, because right now what's happening is that adults are sending kids out on the street to sell drugs to other adults, because the adults, if they were out selling it, would get heavy sentences, whereas kids get fairly light treatment. So nationwide, the drug war has introduced violence and gun use among children on an unprecedented scale, as well as the sale of drugs to kids has increased because of the fact that there's this huge markup in the price of drugs. It's like a subsidy to drug dealers because of the law that makes them illegal. It's a huge markup, 5,000% markup on the average. That means it's real profitable to go in and sell drugs. And who's your most vulnerable market? It's kids. So if you decriminalize it, it'll take a lot of that out of there, and there won't be nearly so much motivation to sell drugs to kids. Also, if we can just manage to get some honest education to our children about drugs and tell them that, it's not such a good idea. It's not such a good idea. I don't know what you're talking about.
Would you like some coffee?
Oh, no thanks. It's not such a good idea to be selling drugs to kids. I've lost my train of thought. You guys passed me a note. I'm supposed to read that and figure out what it is now.
Well, the question at hand, repeat it for the third time, and you're making some very good points, but they aren't really strictly a response to this question, is do you not agree that based upon the model of what happened when alcohol prohibition ended in 1933 and thereabouts, with an upsurge of alcohol abuse and alcohol use, that the same thing is likely to happen with drugs as well?
Okay, what I started to say was that honest education is the only way that we're ever going to stop kids from using drugs. We got to tell them that straight up that marijuana use during school hours is going to screw them up in their learning ability, and therefore they shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. If they receive it in the proper context, in the proper ritual, from people who know what they're talking about, but from people that they will believe, for example, 50-year-old ex-drug users, who have now seen clearly that if they hadn't used drugs when they were 15, they would have done better in life. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of people that ought to be teaching our kids that it's not such a good idea to take drugs when you're 15 or 12.
Sort of like bringing people in off the emphysema ward into the classrooms to show them that smoking is not as glamorous as it's rigged out to be.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we need new rituals on all fronts, but that's one of them that's real crucial to the well-being of our kids. We're victimizing our children on a vast scale, and we have been since the beginning of this drug war, because, as I said, it just results, ironically enough, in an increase in the usage of drugs among kids.
But you have not answered my question, which I will pose a fourth time, Ed Fry, and you have criticized the other candidate, Sam Farr, for evading your questions. I must, shall we say, level the same criticism with you. Will not the decriminalization or legalization of marijuana and hard drugs, if that's in fact what happens, lead in fact to an upsurge, in the absence of anything else, an upsurge in use and abuse among young people?
Right, I did answer that. You weren't listening closely enough. First of all, like I said, when you take away the law that prohibits it, that undercuts that 5,000% markup, so that undercuts the motivation to sell it to kids. That's number one. Number two is when you have honest education, which should accompany the end of the drug war, then the kids will, you know, start following the advice that they receive. As it is now, they're motivated to do just the opposite of what they're told.
Well, actually, I did hear those two points, but I didn't hear you respond to the main point that continues to be made, and actually kind of baffles me. It's something I have to contend with, and I haven't really done a lot of research on it. But I believe that the general point is true, that after alcohol prohibition was overturned by constitutional amendment in 1933, when the Volstead Act was annulled, in essence, there was an upsurge in alcohol use among all sectors of the population, as well as among the young. And that, in fact, the stigma and the criminalization of alcohol, though it did produce major criminal syndicates, Al Capone, etc., it also put a damper on the use of alcohol for a number of people concerned about being legal, having to face criminalization. And I think we have to confront this argument, and I want you to confront it, based upon the example of alcohol prohibition. Is it not the case that we may face a similar problem with drugs?
Well, you know, I don't accept your premise that there was this dramatic increase in the use of alcoholic products.
I'll bring you the data on that.
Well, a lot of the data will show you that whereas during the prohibition, the use of alcohol had to be pretty much restricted to the low volume, high potency varieties such as gin, bourbon, etc. Afterwards, they were able, because of the ease in transportation, of the lighter weight, etc. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, it was more beer was drunk, more of the other lighter liquors were drunk because of the fact that now we were free to market it publicly, so we didn't have to worry about how much it weighed or what and hiding it in smaller places, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So this is my take on it, is that while there was an increase in the absolute volume, the absolute number of ounces per person consumed after prohibition ended, as far as how much the strength of the alcohol, it was really lightened up quite a bit.
Have you in fact studied this case and studied the arguments of those who claim that there was a massive increase in abuse and use of alcohol of all sorts after prohibition ended? I mean, have you actually looked at that?
I haven't made a scholarly study, but I have read some various reports which indicate what I was just saying, and that is that, you know, beforehand people were using stronger stuff, and then they no longer had to. They could take it in lighter doses, which is what a lot of people prefer to do with their alcohol, is take it, sip it a little bit now and then, beer or wine, as opposed to the gin or bourbon.
Well, there are those who feel that prohibition was a good thing, alcohol prohibition, because the consumption of alcohol in the United States prior to 1914, or actually it was 1919 when the act was passed, in the 1800s, for instance, was incredible. It was huge. People used to drink vast amounts of alcohol, three and four times what they drink now. There was some sort of huge amount of alcohol that was drunk. Not sure whether it was because people were having uncomfortable social situations, or as part of the tradition, or I don't know what the hell it was, but that's the claim that I've heard made, that the use of alcohol in the 1880s and 90s was way up there compared to today, and compared, of course, to prohibition. My response, I tend to go along with the traditional arguments of those who favor decriminalization and legalization of drugs, has been that there's always a kind of a percentage of people who abuse anything. Drugs, glue, television, their children, you know, whatever it happens to be. And therefore, You know, it's not a percentage that really is a function of whether it's legal or not. But I also am sensitive to the fact that I tend to be a special pleader, because I have kind of made up my mind, like you have. I'm on the same side that you're on this, and I'd like to be sure that I'm not overlooking real considerations that I may be letting get past.
Well, you know, as far as their higher usage in the 1800s, they didn't have these other addictions available to them, right? Especially like television, one of the ones you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I think television is by far and away the worst addiction we have in this society, based on what it produces in terms of putting people's minds to sleep.
Well, there is the collectible card game addiction that I've run into recently, but that's a personal vice. Yeah, television is a biggie. But of course, there's a lot of addiction to patent medicines, which had a lot of cocaine and opium in them.
And marijuana. And the Lydia Pinkham, the tincture of Lydia Pinkham had a lot of marijuana in it.
Right, although I'm not persuaded, even though there are people from Marijuana Anonymous users, and that's an organization that actually exists in our community, and I invite anyone, by the way, who's a member of that organization to call in at 427-3772, Free Radio Santa Cruz. You are listening, in fact, to Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the unedited edition with Attorney Ed Fry and The Robe, Bathrobes, Pier, Robert Norse, Civil Liberties for the Poor and issues around that particular concern. And for the poor, the drug war is a very important thing, because the poor are on the front line. They don't have no privacy in this circumstance. They can be searched whenever the police want. And the abuse of discretion, the abuse of authority that comes with the huge amounts of money that go to police departments, the huge amounts of power that go to police departments around the drug war, is a real factor, I believe, in creating fear on the streets, creating abuse on the streets for poor people.
It's an instrument of social control, no question about it. For example, the black people in this country commit only 12% of the drug offenses, sales, possession, etc. And there are 12% of the people in this country who are black, so it's perfectly consistent with their numbers. On the other hand, 74% of people who spend time behind bars for drug offenses are black. 3 out of 4. So we got a real problem here, and it's got to come to an end, because we're slipping into chaos and darkness here, and it's getting real bad, and we're going to have to act real soon, or else we're going to have open rebellion, and then more and more severe repression, forms of repression coming down on us.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll be open rebellion, or should we say overt fascism. Unfortunately, I'm afraid people are more interested in, are afraid of rebelling, are uninterested in rebelling, feel that somehow belongs to a decade-long past. Instead, what they're doing is trying to find some way to niche, to fit in, to downsize, to go along, to get along. Some of us are rebels.
As opposed to what's happening in Mexico, the middle class in Mexico now see that they can't get along the way things are, and they are themselves conducting and participating in huge demonstrations of protest in various forms. So the Zapatistas are only one form of protest and rebellion in Mexico. And the middle class, so-called middle class, they're getting shoved down into the lower areas of economic levels. But they're going to banks and sitting in at banks, and they're engaging in various other kinds of resistance to the government. So it's, and I think that's what we have to do here. We have to realize that maybe we're members of the middle class, or nominally at least members of the middle class still, but if present trends continue, there's only going to be two classes, and that is the overclass and the underclass, and 95% of us are going to be in the underclass. So we've got to decide that there's going to come a day when we have to stand in front of the machine and not stand for it anymore, and not permit the corporate control of everything, such that our lives are totally regimented and our pocketbooks are picked.
Candidate I've heard that's actually been calling for revolution, rebellion.
Well, I don't say revolution in the sense of armed revolution, but certainly stop the machine in a passive way. Just stand in front of the machine and don't let it pass. that's the only way that to get the kind of attention that we need to the problems. It's the only way the simple-minded media, well, I shouldn't say they're not so simple-minded, actually. They're controlled completely by the corporate interests. So they're pretty much intelligently directing all attention away from the plight of the poor. But and that's the only way to bring their attention back is to stand in front of the machine.
Well, now, we have a machine coming up today at City Council. The Citizens Police Review Board meets at 5 o'clock at City Hall to rubber stamp our fair police department. I just had a phone back from Deputy Police Chief Jeff Locke, who told me that if I didn't like the police department's decision on my most recent complaint, I should just go to court. He said that in a rather friendly way. Jeff and I, we don't have anything against each other personally. I've got a very trivial case. It's just a typical example of how the police department supports this kind of blue coat of silence all the way along the line, you know, regardless of how preposterous the situation is. I've discussed the case before involved a ticket in the Beach Flats late at night where one of my lights was supposedly defective, according to the officer who stopped me, Officer Brandt. However, the sergeant, I think his name was Sergeant, was it Warner? Vogel, perhaps. Sergeant Vogel came to the scene and saw the situation, and he saw that the light was working, and so he told Officer Brandt, well, write it off, because Brandt had already written me a ticket. So instead of tearing up the ticket, they wrote off the ticket that they had just done. I went to court, of course, and I found them have to pay $10 for their little mistake.
Listen, Robert, I don't want to interrupt you, but I do have to run.
Well, in any case, I invite you, Ed, to come on to the Citizens Police Review Board meeting at 5, and also tomorrow at 3:30, City Council is considering something that may involve civil disobedience locally, namely the existence of the open-air shelter, where 200 to 300 people have the only legal place to sleep in Santa Cruz. That's tomorrow at 3:30 at City Council. And I would like to ask your opinion on that issue, perhaps sometime in the future. It's not one that you've been talking about, and I'd like to see if you would favor supporting local civil disobedience to stop the dislodging of hundreds of people who have only one safe place to sleep at the moment.
I absolutely do support it, and I will be there to support it with my body as well as my
spirit. So you, me, and Barb Riverwoman are going to be hauled away with all these campers, eh?
Well, that's possible.
So if you're interested in supporting civil disobedience, come tonight, 7 o'clock, to Save Our Shelter, a meeting at the Underground Cafe, which is in the basement of the Veterans Building. We are planning protests, that is to say HUF is, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We're going to propose that to SOS, Save Our Shelter, the group that represents the campers. And we want to see what kind of support you can give to those people who are outside. You can hear that rain? Well, they are right underneath it. So check it out. And Ed Fry, thank you very much for coming today to our underground studios here on Underground Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
My pleasure, Robert, as usual.
Hey, it's always fun being with Ed. And we are, in fact, with you on your radio, if you can hear us. People have been having trouble hearing us today at 96.3 FM. Calling number, if any of this conversation has reached you and interested you, is 427-3772. I think that Dave, the merry prankster who has returned after doing battle with the drug war in another jurisdiction, has kind of disappeared after delivering us some coffee. That's it's real sweet of him to bring us the coffee. I hope he comes back and can talk to us some more. I want to make another quick pitch for Save Our Shelters. They're looking for pallets, tents, tarps, Coleman stoves, lamps, flashlights, batteries, rope candles, propane tanks, gloves, winter coats, sweaters, flannel shirts, long johns, scarves, hats, socks, outdoor shoes, raincoats, rain boots, rain jackets, rubber boots, umbrellas, blankets, sleeping bags, and perhaps most important of all, a pump. They are going to need a pump like they need nothing else, a 5,000, 10,000 gallon pump to get that field pumped out, or that field is going to flow away and the entire campground with it. So if you want to help out, give a call to 425-5939, 425-5939, 425-5939. Talk to Barbara. She can help you deliver any of this stuff. And if you want to help find a pump, give a call. We need volunteers to do that. And if you're interested, of course, in talking about this subject, Free Radio Santa Cruz, lines are open, 427-3772, 427-3772. Tomorrow at City Council, yes, the whole issue comes up again. Citizens Committee for the Homeless is going to try to loot existing programs.
and get more money for their community house project. What is that project? It's a $1.3 million trailer project that will house 48 people who pay $200 to $600 a month and will evict 200 to 300 campers that are currently sleeping at the only legal place to sleep in Santa Cruz, namely the open-air shelter at 111 Coral Street, River Street, and Highway 1. The only legal place actually in the city to sleep, and the only legal open-air shelter that I've heard of in the state that currently exists, and possibly in the country. And I keep repeating that figure because I think it's of historic importance what's going on here. I think that if it becomes a viable prospect here in Santa Cruz, people are not going to flock to Santa Cruz because it's a green, muddy place out there. It's no fun, folks. But other cities, other jurisdictions may find that this is a cost-effective way to deal with emergency shelter instead of pussyfooting around and babbling about affordable housing like Jane Hokimana, our council members, and Cynthia Matthews do all the time. Oh, we don't want these campers to be so undignified as to be sitting in a tent. We'd rather have them sitting in jail or possibly not sitting at all. That's why we have our sitting ban. No, what we need is a reality that reflects the reality of what's going on in our cities and in our country today, that there is no housing for millions of people, that there are no jobs for millions of people, that there is no shelter for millions of people. And we have to respond to this by at least letting them fend for themselves in some kind of circumstance where that's a possibility. And this campground is an example of people effectively fending for themselves, supporting each other, helping each other, self-governing a campground themselves. Apropos of which, I have recorded, as some of you know who've been following Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, some of the campground debates that have been developing out there. They had their first meeting on the campground. And they had their first meeting on December 6th, and they're going to have another one on Wednesday at 1 o'clock out there to organize and form their own rules. And I'm going to play a little bit of this tape, a little bit more of this tape, of how this actually went. You get to see nascent democracy. You get to see kind of a constitutional convention in progress.
That's one of the things that was outlined here, is that what we need to do is designate certain areas.
You're listening to Rolling Thunder Mike Sheridan, who was chairing that meeting of about 15 or 20 campers with a couple of community activists and a couple of members of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program that were overseeing that open-air campground sitting in. Let's hear more of Mike.
And so the way I figured is someone would volunteer, or a couple people would volunteer, would draw up a map of the camp and go around and decide which people are already in affinity groups and which people are living individually. And once we've decided that there are four camps, five camps, six camps within the camp where people are grouped together, then we would ask those people in that area to take care of the cleanup in their area, to appoint representatives, to appoint monitors, and deal with problems within each of these camps. And that would involve cleanup daily, and also appointing or electing volunteers who will take part in doing some of the community areas daily, whether it's the sink, the porta potties, the dining area, or whatever we decide is a common area that needs input from volunteers. And each group will come up with some of these volunteers, as well as keeping their own areas clean and secure. Can that be agreed upon? So it means someone, we need to put together a map here in the next day or so and figure out which these areas are, people want to call themselves such and such a camp, such and such a camp, and we'll have an idea of who's there, and we'll begin to get a clear list of who the monitor is from this group, who's doing the cleanup, who the volunteers are for common areas. But this will be decided by the groups within the next couple of days, and we'll put a map together. Is that agreed?
Yeah, agreed.
I we have to choose. Do we want to encourage the weak and the ill or the drug and alcohol abusers or self-destructive people to go to the army and church shelters? That is, do we actually want to go up to them and say, we think it would be best for you if you went and had care or you were in the shelter? Not because we think they're bad, but we think that this is best for them. That we go around and talk to them calmly and reasonably and say, we think you'd be better off there. Which doesn't mean they have to go. They still have a choice to say, to stay, that we would only be making them go if they then become a problem to us based on things that they do. So we would first advise people, we think it's better for you to go to the armory and try to help them or to get the social service help. Can we agree to do that? Is anybody against that?
Yes.
I have a problem.
I am.
It's much easier to lose a church, even if they said like such program, when they could pay a 30 years. And I can't condone sending people to get out having their social behavior or for abusive or for drug use. And we know they are to a facility that we've had in Portland for years. We take the chance of losing us because of one individual. But the armory is okay.
Is the armory okay?
I think it should come under the
warning. The first thing you're going to be, we're just inviting
it. It didn't do a major thing. It should come under warning.
I think we got several kind of categories of behavior here.
Yeah.
Hard drug and alcohol use, we don't want in the army, we don't want in prison, we don't want in food. So the option isn't saying, we don't think you can do it here, maybe you can do it in the army. The option is, this is not the place for it, and the army's not the place for it, and the church is not the place for it. In terms of people with mental illness, that's a different category.
So we should separate
some people are not capable of taking care of themselves, at least taking care of themselves well.
And we should make a distinction between those who have mental and emotional problems or physical problems and those who are abusers in some way.
And once you're dealing simply with mentally ill people with physical problems, I think you have every right to express your care and say, you know, this really isn't working out for you. We need more help than we're able to give you here. And then, either through the ISSP monitors or through care and try to get them into some sort of services that would help them. Now, it may not be that, you know, they can get residential services somewhere, and most of them probably won't, given the services thing. But at least, you know, we might be able to accommodate them with a little more care in the armory or even in the church. Those people, I think, you know, we simply have to deal with on a case-by-case basis.
That's the voice of pardonnez-moi, Paul Merceau, who's the head of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, the Open Air Shelter, the guy who's being paid to run it by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, and he is also one of the two men who is authorized to negotiate on behalf of CCH throughout this next month to make sure that, supposedly that the shelter remains open unless it's floated and flooded away and there's no other alternative. I think they also had some other provisos, provided they have money, provided they have staffing, but the general understanding was that it would stay open. A comment about pardonnez-moi Paul, as I call him. Paul, I nothing but the friendliest feelings for as a human being. I haven't liked his public statements recently, however, before the youth subcommittee. I believe I mentioned this earlier in the program, of the Above the Line Community Consortium, a group concerned with youth shelter. He misstated the number of people living in the campground, underestimating it by two-thirds, which really ticked me off. He claimed there were 63 tents, and indicating that nobody had any problems with the armory. In fact, less than 30 people used the armory last night. There were 125 odd tents. I counted 96 2 hours after he had said there were 62. I asked him if he stood by his figure. He said no. He didn't say that he stood by his figure, but he said that was the figure he got from his staff. Well, I'd like to see him stand by an accurate figure. I'd like to see him stand by a true figure. I'd like to see him take responsibility for information he's propounding and not hide behind his staff. Paul, get it together. That's what I said to him. That's what I continue to say to him. You hear discussion here of ground rules. This is a meeting on last Wednesday of ground rules that the campers themselves wanted to establish, though Paul was a part of this whole discussion, as were the rest of us. Ground rules on who could stay, on what the rules were, on what people wanted to agree on for this winter campground, which is a unique experiment in Santa Cruz history. The best of my knowledge, there's never been a winter campground in Santa Cruz that I've heard of in terms of a self-managed homeless campground. That hasn't happened. It hasn't happened anywhere that I've heard of. I guess they've had winter campgrounds maybe in Phoenix or year-round campgrounds in Phoenix, maybe Los Angeles. There was a tent city for a while. I think there was in 1987, in January and February of 87, there was a tent city. But this is the first one I've seen here and the first one I've seen recently happening. It's a very important experiment, and I think this is a really significant debate you're hearing here. It's interesting, the ground rules they eventually came up with had to do with evicting people who were engaging in abusive hard drug use. And I myself, as you may have heard in the earlier conversation about the drug war, I don't like people who are screaming late at night and stealing stuff from your house or your tent, but these are other behaviors than using drugs. And I myself have to take the position that if you use a drug, that's your own business. It's if you are engaging in theft and engaging in loud, boisterous, obnoxious behavior, selling to minors, prostituting people against their will or because they're underage, these are considerations that obviously are important. Of course, campers at the campground take a different perspective, and I perhaps might take a different perspective myself if I were living out there in a tent. As I thought I would be a couple of weeks ago, and I may still be, because my room is flooding out even though I'm paying rent for it. Drip, drip, drip. Oh, boy. But that's another story. Still, there were about apparently 5 to 10 people who were evicted or expelled, as you may have heard from Rolling Thunder Mike's report. He's the fellow who's chairing this meeting. He's the fellow who's on this tape on last Wednesday. He also called in earlier, several hours ago, on the main part of Bathrobe Spears Broadside, the main part of the show. He pointed out that different people were kicked out for hard drug use, which I think is a bad reason to kick somebody out, but certainly if the use is abusive, and just, that's another matter. I talked to one of these individuals who happened to be standing across the street from the radio station when I came out of the station about an hour and a half ago, a man named Brian. Brian was rather upset with, he said, Karen Gillette and the people of the open-air shelter. Actually, it wasn't the people who kicked him out, it was the management that kicked him out, but apparently they may have done this in consultation with the people, the users of the open-air shelter program. He said that he had been away for a time and his tent was being used by people who were abusing drugs, but he himself had not. He had not gotten a fair hearing. And I've heard this on a number of different occasions. Some claim that people inside Karen's own program or inside the open-air shelter in the last 3 or 4 months ago were, you know, drug users, and they could do whatever they wanted, but then they pointed the finger and fucked with people who they didn't like. And this kind of thuggishness or cliquishness or special privileges for the few is always a problem. But I think and I hope that with an increased self-management happening at the campground, with weekly meetings where people can really say what they want, with activists and community members supporting and watching, and with a real crisis developing here where there's a winter flooding, rain happening, cold conditions, people not able to go to the armory for different reasons. With this situation as it is, we can not only, you know, agree to, but to look at these circumstances a second and a third time, but also the people who are being evicted for these reasons, drug use and drug abuse, will be given really fair hearings. And I hope that I asked Brian to write a letter about this situation to the Open Air Shelter Subcommittee if he feels he has been improperly treated. And hopefully they will consider it. I want to see an appeals process in the event that there has been a problem. I don't know whether he's been treated properly or improperly, but I do know that I'm glad to see what seems to be a fair and somewhat democratic process developing, which takes into account the input of many people and realistically asserts deals with concerns of people in the shelter and isn't just an assertion of the bureaucratic preferences of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless or what might be the prejudices of the community or the city council that the open-air shelter has to appeal to. No, but the real needs and desires and concerns of the people in the open-air shelter, in the coral reefs, as Barbara Riverwoman calls it, campground. itself. Let's hear some more of this historic meeting, the Constitutional Convention of the Open Air Shelter.
Yeah, I think we've seen in the past that some of those people can't be on the Rocky Mountain Road. I think that I'd like to project right now that because within one of these things it says about sleeping here on the tables and not having it or whatever, usually we talk all the way around this and block off the wind, that any of the crazy people be protected enough in here. Is that agreeable or not?
Well, we're going to do that.
People can sleep on the tables or not.
Well, that's really kick everybody off, and all we have is four
about now.
The mental you.
Can we agree that we would advise people who have emotional, physical, or mental problems that they should seek indoor shelter for the winter, that they'd be better off in their own health and safety doing that? This is not a warning. This is not a threat. This is just advising that we will help them to find social service help to do this. Different from drug and alcohol abusers. Does anyone object to that? We want to help some of these people, is what we're trying to say. Is that okay? Okay. Okay, I'm going to start now on the list of actual choices, yes and no. What about extra bike racks? Do we, are bicycles becoming a problem? Do we want to create a rack or a special area around somewhere for extra bicycles and leave more camp space and living space? Yes or no?
Yes.
We do. Okay, can we create a show of hands instead of voices because it's harder to count?
Yes.
Do we want to do this?
Yes. Right.
Yes.
I think another part of that might be getting rid of the jump bikes that were just thrown up against the fence, nobody's using, somebody stole the parts or whatever and they crashed.
Okay, we'll put that in the form of a question. Do we want to pressure people to remove their junky bikes and bike parts away? This would include Hollywood, of course, you know, and we have to think about that. Do you want Hollywood to clear away some of his junk and his business?
So there's
two questions here, actually. Individuals that leave bicycles laying around, you want them to stop that, is that right? Is that the way we should say it?
I'd say anything that any bicycle is thrown left around, go through Hollywood and see if he wants to junk it.
Yeah.
If he wants to junk it, then throw it away.
Right.
It may be junk and not know it.
Right, if Hollywood might be able to use it,
that bike would be in charge of all the bikes. You can have a bike rack over here, you can be the monitor of all the bikes.
Lock the bikes in the yard, no guidance. Yeah, I have been close to being hit two or three times.
Okay, are we agreed that the extra bikes left laying around will be offered to Hollywood, and if he doesn't want them, they'll be thrown away? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a stipulation on that, but we should hold it for maybe like a few days.
Is it worth anything at all? We're talking about junk bikes, not really even parts that are left laying around the camp.
Suggesting that bikes be left on the property.
Okay.
Somebody's stealing them.
Someone's raising another question. Do we want bikes left on the property?
Of course, yeah. I think that's a good idea.
No more riding bikes on the campground?
It's a good rule, but it's hard to enforce.
We should stop it. Including myself, I ride my bike in here.
Okay. Do we want the bikes walked on the campgrounds?
Yes.
Definitely.
They've been close to being hit a few times. That's something that has to be enforced.
And that was the Wednesday meeting, the first meeting of the Open Air Shelter community gathering at the campground to make its own rules. And you get to hear the rather kind of minutia process of rule development that went on there. It's very important because this is the kind of thing that happened in in 1789 at the Constitutional Convention. The difference is, in the United States, it happened with a bunch of rich lawyers deciding for everybody else. These people are deciding for themselves. Very significant situation developing here. I'm going to have to break into this tape and end this because the proper talk show hosts who have arrived here, and I'm going to have to vacate, and I'm going to do that very shortly, and I want to thank them for their indulgence as I kind of wind down this extended version of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I want to remind you, if you want to be on Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the thing for you to do is give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's also the number for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom and my home phone, assuming it's not drenched in water. I have a serious leak in my room. If any people want to patch it up, hey, give me a call, 423-HUFF. We're also planning demonstrations to downtown. We're thinking of trying to do some homeless Christmas caroling in the next weeks ahead because it seems that the Citizens Committee for the Homeless does not want to change its position. The city and the county do not want to encourage the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, who owns the property on which the campground sits and which is going to be turned into a no-man's zone starting in January so that Community House, the Trailers Not Trolls project of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, can go forward. We urge you to oppose that project unless there is another legal place for people to be able to sleep at night, for people to have a tent during the day. This community area is a vital resource, and it's going to come up tomorrow, 3:30 at Community's City Council. At the City Council meeting tomorrow at 3:30 at City Hall, you will be able to speak out in favor of retaining the open-air shelter. Please, show up, be there, support the campers, and tell Community House, no, you don't oppose their having transitional housing. You don't oppose their using donated trailers for Stanford. You don't even oppose a $1.3 million project that requires you be drug-free and sober, and that requires you spend $200 to $600 a month, and only deals with 48... 48-